Hello and welcome. It is Eric Erickson here. I sure hope you're doing well. The phone number, if you'd like to be a part of the program, 877-97-ERIC, 877-973-7425. We must begin to some degree with a bit of a repetition from yesterday. I'll liven it up for you if you were here. By the way, If you happen to see like a clip of the show today, I don't know when the last time was I shaved. I mean, and it's starting to get a little gray. I'm starting to, I don't like this gray. Still got more like hair that's not gray than Philip, and he's like half my age. Nonetheless, I digress. All right. So here's the thing. The Democrats need Republican help to continue funding the government, to avoid a government shutdown, and they need the Republicans' help, in particular, on the debt ceiling, or so they think. And we need to spend a little bit of time with this and let this marinate in our minds. And I should tell you as well, Dan Crenshaw from Texas is going to join me at the bottom of this hour to talk about the border in Afghanistan. Let me set the stage for you here, though. The Democrats have a margin of zero in the United States Senate. It is a 50-50 Senate. Kamala Harris has to break tie votes. They cannot afford to lose a single Democrat on anything. In the House of Representatives, given vacancies and the like, they can't afford to lose more than three. The last time the Democrats controlled the House and the Senate, they had margins where they could lose a dozen or so in the House. They could lose three or four in the Senate. They had wiggle room. Right now, the Democrats are playing a game where they act like they have a majority coalition that is larger than it actually is. They're playing the Democrats 2018 game. They're playing the Democrats, I don't know, 2009 game. They're playing a game as if they, or they're legislating, I shouldn't say they're playing a game, they're legislating as if they have a majority coalition as large as it was when Barack Obama first took office after the Bush era. And they don't. They can lose not a single member in the Senate unless they can gain Republicans. In the House, they can only lose three Democrats unless they have Republicans to offset them. But there's a problem. The Democrats in the House and in the Senate do not want to work with the Republicans. They do not want to build a governing coalition with the Republicans. They don't want to allow Republican collaboration in the legislative process because the Democrats would like to keep themselves together and, with the help of the American press, alienate, marginalize, and condemn the Republicans and tie them all to January 6th. You hear this over and over and over. In fact, at CNN yesterday, the top seven articles at the top of CNN.com were all about Donald Trump and January 6th and that lawyer's stupid letter on advising Mike Pence on how he could overthrow the election. He couldn't. It was a stupid, stupid letter. The Democrats don't want Republican help. They say they're still traumatized. They say the Republicans are terrible. Really what it is they want all the credit. Because in the midterms, if the Democrats are going to mitigate the typical historic damage done to the incumbent party that holds the White House, they got to take all the credit for everything. And so there's no credit to give because they can't share any credit. They can't build anything because in the House of Representatives, there is a great divide among the Democrats between the progressives and just the liberals. It's liberal and more liberal. It's not really moderate or even conservative. It's liberals and far left nuts. In the House of Representatives, the squad, as they call it, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and the rest, they get fawning media coverage. They think they are ascendant. And they are true believers in their progressive cause. There's something that AOC and Rashida Tlaib and them have never tasted. Defeat. Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats back in 2009-2010 decided it was worth losing to pass Obamacare. They actually thought that they would not lose if they passed Obamacare, but even if they did lose, it was worth losing because they knew, and they were right, that we'd never get rid of Obamacare once it was passed. it was worth it. And they figured if they lost, they would rebound pretty quickly and come back because people would love Obamacare. So they passed Obamacare. Remember, Scott Brown won in Massachusetts, the Republican opposed to Obamacare. It was a big red flag that the Democrats shouldn't go down this road. And then I forget what else happened in the Senate, but they were able to override a filibuster. They were able to pass a lot through reconciliation as well without needing to worry about the filibuster. They got up to 60. Boom, they did it. And the voters swept the Democrats out to sea. It took a little while in the Senate, but the destruction was consistent in the Senate over three elections. In the House, it was immediate. And Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats had convinced themselves that if they lost, they would come right back. And they didn't. They lost in 2010. They lost in 2012. They lost in 2014. They lost in 2016. Not only that, but Donald Trump got elected. It wasn't until 2018 that they came back. And now they've had control of the House in 2018. They had control of the House in 2020. They expected to expand their margins in the House in 2020. All the polling showed them they had a blue wave coming. They were going to expand their majority in the House. The Republican polling showed it. The Democratic polling showed it. The nonpartisan polling showed it. The pollsters all got it wrong. Instead of a massive win, they nearly lost their House majority. They came within five seats, and then with the number of deaths and setbacks and then special elections, they can only afford, they've now got essentially a three-seat margin of error. They didn't see that coming. That was totally unexpected. Nobody on any side saw it. Anyone who says they saw it is lying. It wasn't in the cards, and yet it happened. The polling was all wrong. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, they've never had to worry about not being at the power center. They've never had to worry about being in exile. They've never had to worry about these things. They never have had to worry about being in the minority. They don't know what it's like. They have no recognition. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez assumed office January 3rd, 2019. She and the squad running. They've been in the majority the whole time. Nancy Pelosi knows what it's like to wander in the wilderness, particularly when you don't think you deserve to wander in the wilderness. So Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, they're on the far left. If they get their way, they're more moderate members. They're just liberal members. They're going to lose. They're going to be toast. They will be in the minority. They don't understand how this works. They've never had to experience it. They don't know the taste of defeat. They've never snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. The rest of the Democratic coalition knows. And so there is a great divide in the Democratic Party. So you have dogmatic progressive members who insist that it's their way or the highway. And you've got the Democratic leader, Steny Hoyer, who's been in the majority and in the minority, back and forth, back and forth. Nancy Pelosi, this is her last term in Congress. Nancy Pelosi's done. They know what it's like when you say my way or the highway. They don't want the highway. They know what the highway is like. These young progressive members, they have no idea. They've never been in the minority. They can't conceive of it because their entire bubble tells them that they are the majority. They go to the Met with their tax the rich dress and all the rich people pat them on the head. Oh, you're so wonderful. We so agree with you. Tax us more, knowing they won't. The media loves them. The young media members, male and female, tend to be almost as far left, if not further left, than Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. So they tell them in the majority, every single way they look, every direction, up, down, left, right, forward, behind them, tells them they are the majority, that the American public agrees with them. They don't know what it's like to be in the minority. They don't even realize they're in the bubble. Pelosi does, Hoyer does. They've been around the block. These are 80-year-old people who've been in politics forever. They know what it's like to be in the bubble. And they've shut the Republicans out of the process. The Republicans have no role to play in this. And in the process of shutting the Republicans out, they could have had regular order. They could have let the committees actually shape legislation. Instead, leadership is drafting it, punting it to the committees. They're shutting the Republicans out. The Democrats want to own this. The Democrats want to take credit for all of it. They don't want to work with the Republicans. They don't want the Republicans to take credit. They don't want to give the Republicans an inch because they're afraid they'll take a mile. And so they're shaping all this legislation. The result is the Democrats have painted themselves into a corner on the edge of the fiscal cliff. And they can't get out of it without Republican help. They need Republican votes to raise the debt ceiling, particularly in the Senate, unless they throw in reconciliation. They can't throw raising the debt ceiling in the reconciliation package that bypasses the filibuster because they've already structured it through the budget. So they'll have to amend the budget to then amend reconciliation, and it'll take longer than we have before we get to the debt ceiling. So now they're insisting Republicans throw them a lifeline. They don't want to have the Republicans participate in anything. They want to kill the bipartisan infrastructure bill unless the Democrats are able to pass their $3.5 trillion spending package. Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema, the senator, say, nope, we're not giving you $3.5 trillion. So the progressives in the House are like, well, then screw y'all, we're going to burn it all down. There's no path forward for the Democrats right now without the Republicans, and the Democrats don't have a plan. They thought they could govern and shut the Republicans out because they assumed they could govern just like they governed back in 2009 when they had a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate for a short time, and they had a dominant commanding position in the House. They thought they could get away with it. They thought they could do it. And they can't. They can't. So they don't know what to do. The Republicans know what to do. Let them drown. Let them drown. Don't throw them a lifeline. Because, you know, in politics, no one actually ever drowns. I mean, the Democrats aren't going to die. Maybe at the ballot box, they'll be slaughtered. But the Republicans can force the Democrats off the fiscal cliff. See, the way it actually works, it's the media never willfully, the media never wants to be honest with this. The Democrats never willfully, truly want to be honest with this. The way it actually works is that if you hit the fiscal cliff, if you reach the debt ceiling, the Secretary of the Treasury is forced by law to start paying all of the debts of the country and nothing else. So all the Medicare payments, all the Social Security payments, all the Department of Education payments, all of the payments, all the 4A payments, everything has to go to pay the debt. Everything's got to go to pay the debt. You can't raise the debt. You can't take more bonds. You can't increase the debt. So all the money that's coming into the Treasury has to go to pay the interest on the debt and nothing else. Because you have to honor the full faith and credit of the United States. So it's not like we truly default. The media always treats it as a default. It's not a default unless Janet Yellen, the Secretary of the Treasury, commits malpractice as treasurer. She's got to pay the debt. She can't pay anything else. So you won't get your Medicare payment. You won't get your Medicaid payment. You won't get your Social Security payment. You won't get your Board of Education payment. You won't get anything. You won't get your extended child tax credit benefit because the debt has to be paid. The full faith and credit of the United States has to be honored constitutionally. You can't get out of it. That's not a default. The media treats it as a default. It's just Armageddon for the Democrats because they control everything. And this is part of the problem for the Democrats. They have wanted everyone to know they control everything. The Democrats have wanted you to know they control the House. The Democrats have wanted you to know they control the Senate. The Democrats wanted you to know they control the White House. So if they control everything and they have a path with reconciliation to get the debt ceiling extended without having to deal with the filibuster, they're going to have to do it. And they don't want to do it. They want the Republicans to bless it. Here's the thing. The Republicans are not going to allow the Democrats to pass a human infrastructure plan that the Democrats say fundamentally changes America and then have the Republicans say, I guess we got to raise the debt ceiling so y'all can pay for this thing none of us want. That's not how it works. It's like, how are the Democrats so bad at this? How have they forgotten you don't have that majority coalition? Except the problem is they actually have, at the leadership level, remembered that. They just have a bunch of young, hardcore, true-believing progressives who've never known what it's like to be in the minority and can't conceive of ever being in the minority because they're in a bubble where everyone tells them they'll never be in the minority, that history is bending to their side. History's about to boot them out of office. This hour of the program brought to you by First Liberty Building and Loan. They're in Noonan, Georgia, but they can help you anywhere in the United States of America. And they want to help your business become a big business. If you need loans, six figures and above, you got big plans for your business, they want to help you. They want to help you get to yes, where banks are saying no. Go to FirstLibertyGA.com, FirstLibertyGA.com. Spend 10 minutes with them. See if they're a good fit for you. See if you're a good fit for them. See if they can help your business grow. FirstLibertyGA.com. Thanks to them for sponsoring the program. Don't look now, but the Gallup poll is showing Joe Biden's approval rating hits a new low of 43% for him. Now, I haven't seen, let's pull up the Real Clear Politics average polling together. Biden job approval, it's negative 4.1. It has him at 46 approve, 50% disapprove. That's Gerald Ford territory, which ain't good. The last two polls that have him down 10 are Rasmussen and Gallup, both down 10. Economist has him down 2. Politico has him down 3. Reuters has him down 6. Harvard Harris has him down 2. Fox News actually has him up 1. Quinnipiac has him down 6. Monmouth University has him up 1. It's not good for the president when Gallup does. Now, why Gallup? The thing you got to understand about Gallup is that its polling is not that great anymore. It used to be, but it's not that great anymore. That they've had some methodology problems, except Gallup has polled continuously going back to World War II. And the problem here is that for Joe Biden, not for Gallup, is that Gallup actually for approval polling has a historic base of polling. And so even though they may have the number exactly right, they have an unchanging pool of people so you can see the trend. So if Gallup's trending down, the odds are the president actually is going down in his polling. Even if it's not, like they say, negative or the 43% approve, that may not be the right number. Maybe it's 47%. Maybe it's 35%. But the fact that Gallup continuously polls the same group, not the same individual people, but the same profile of people, and that shows him trending down with Gallup, is pretty significant. The latest drop, this is from Gallup, the latest drop in Biden's job approval score is the second significant decline since June. Biden's honeymoon ratings, near 55%, first faltered in July, falling to 50%. Midway through the most recent polls field period, as U.S. COVID-19 cases, hospitalizations, and deaths continue to rise, Biden announced new directives to limit the spread of the disease. Except for Donald Trump, every U.S. president since Harry Truman has enjoyed a honeymoon period characterized by above-average approval ratings upon taking office. Biden's recent slides in approval put him in the company of Trump and Bill Clinton, whose ratings were at or below Biden's current 43% at some point in the first 8 months of their presidencies. However, by September 1993, Clinton's approval ratings began to recover and averaged 50% that month. Yes, but then what happened in the midterms in 1994? The Democrats got wiped out. Democrats' approval of Joe Biden has remained high and not varied more than 8 points. Their high rating for Biden was 98. Their current is 90. Republicans have ranged from 12% to 6%. Joe Biden's problem, independents. Currently 37% approval rating in independents. His lowest date, 24 points behind his personal high of 61% with independents. 37% with independents is awful news for Joe Biden and for the Democrats' ability to get anything done. I may have to send out my brisket recipe this week. I need to. The phone number here, 877-973-7425. It is Eric Erickson. Apple just sent me a text message. My iPhone has shipped. The Chinese will be spying on me in 2 days. It's like having Jesus in my hands. I can't wait to get my new iPhone. But that's not what I'm here to talk about. Right now, I got a guest, Congressman Dan Crenshaw of Texas, joining me by phone. Welcome to the program.
Eric, how you doing? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to talk to you about Afghanistan, obviously, but we got to talk about this border situation. Chip Roy, a friend of mine, was on with me last week talking about what he had seen down there. I know you've been down there as well. Can you just kind of give us the lay of the land?
Well, unfortunately, it's a lot of the same, just getting worse. You've got an administration that won't enforce our laws, and therefore there's a lot of people who want to take advantage of that. The situation is as simple as that. And it's also a pretty simple fix, to be honest. It's enforcing our laws and going back to some of the policies that we had under Trump, particularly the asylum cooperation agreements and the migrant protection protocols. These were good policies that disincentivized crossing. And what you have now is just what is a completely unsustainable crossing flow. It's unsustainable in so many ways. It's unsustainable culturally. When you talk about the simple ideas of national sovereignty and our ability to absorb foreigners into a country, I mean, you cannot protect the American ideal, the American sense of self, if without any kind of border, right? It totally defeats the purpose of a country to begin with. So there's that, which is in a sense more of a philosophical argument, but it also has really practical implications, overwhelming a lot of our emergency rooms, overwhelming our education system, it also putting downward pressure on wages. This is something that Bernie Sanders used to be very vocal about. A lot of labor-centric Democrats were very vocal about in the past, and they changed their tune because they realized that it was far more beneficial to get shout outs from radical immigration activists than it was to actually protect American workers.
That's a good point.
And, hence the electoral swing towards Trump, I think, in 2016.
Well, you raised that point. I've been spending a lot of time on this. I'm sure you've seen the Texas Monthly article on how the Democrats just assumed that Hispanic voters would swing to the Democrats. And yet in South Texas and the border counties of Colorado and the southern end of Colorado, even in Florida, we're seeing a real shift toward not just Trump, but the GOP with Hispanic voters, as Democrats just seem like they not only have played identity politics with people who want to be Americans, not boxed in as Hispanic voters, but people who took the time to come here legally. And now we're seeing this humanitarian crisis on the border.
That's exactly right. You talk to Hispanic voters, and this is especially true in Texas. You can't lump all Hispanic voters into one category. Different in California, they're more inclined to vote Democrat than they are in Texas. And they're swinging pretty wildly in Texas, as you've noted. And the reason is exactly that. They will state that they did it the right way. This isn't fair. And it's immoral to just allow people to cut the line. My stepmom is a legal immigrant from Peru. And she talks about this all the time, how infuriating it is. It took years to get citizenship. And they feel a real sense of injustice when this kind of thing happens. And look, I think among the many reasons Democrats do this is because they do believe that they're basically importing a huge voter block for themselves. And there's plenty of proof of this. I mean, every action they take leads to more illegal immigration. And then on the back end, they promote legislation that would give illegal immigrants amnesty. They tried to do that in this reconciliation bill, but the Senate parliamentarian struck it down, as we assumed she would, right. But it was great to see that she did. And so that's their goal. Now on the good news for conservatives is it's far from obvious that this would create some voter block for them. Okay, we shouldn't be so accepting of this Democrat falsehood that Hispanics just automatically vote Democrat because they want welfare. Okay, it's not necessarily true, and we shouldn't accept that premise, just to be clear, electorally. So, I think we just got to keep fighting this.
Yeah, it's frustrating that we get into the identity politics here, which actually does lead me into the Afghan situation, where we continue to see a number of refugees come into this country. A lot of people who came in here, maybe we rushed and they shouldn't have, but then a lot of people who should be here, we rushed it and they couldn't. And I continue to hear about these humanitarian crisis stories of people, Americans, stepping up themselves, trying to get people out of Afghanistan, and this administration keeps throwing up roadblocks. Congressman? Something happened along the way. I'm afraid we've lost the congressman. Let's see if we can try to get him back. I have no idea. Sorry about that, folks. definitely want to get him on the phone about Afghanistan. Let's see. Nope, I am afraid we've lost him. But I can carry on about this Afghan situation. You know, we had John Androsik on yesterday, who was up. Oh, here we go. Let's see here. And I think I've got Congressman Crenshaw back. Sorry about that. I'm not sure what happened.
Yeah, I don't know. Chinese screwing with us.
Definitely, definitely. My iPhone's jealous that the new one's coming. It's screwing up on me now. So let me ask you about Afghanistan. I had John Andresic yesterday from Five for Fighting, who's done a protest song about it. He says, as a musician with contacts in the USO and the like, he's having people reach out to him through WhatsApp saying, can you help me get out of Afghanistan? And the administration keeps throwing up roadblocks for everybody.
Yeah. A couple things on this. One, we need to get used to these stories. This is the unfortunate reality of pulling out of Afghanistan. And anyone who wants to pretend otherwise has been lying to themselves and lying to everyone else. So that's the first thing. There will be an endless number of humanitarian crises going on in Afghanistan. An endless number of stories that are sickening to you. I just saw a video of Taliban hanging people and then shooting them in like a little makeshift gallows that they've created. This is what they'll do, and this is the consequences of our actions. And the reality is that a lot of people on both sides wanted this exact thing, so I don't want to hear any complaints about it from those folks. And I feel very strongly about this. And now the second thing is, you know, is the administration doing anything about it? And that's the even worse part, right? Like, if you're gonna screw something up, take some responsibility for it and do your best to get at least American citizens out. You know, I would advocate for our allies as well, people who've worked with us. We should be doing everything we can. Now, everything we can is in a whole lot, unfortunately, again, because we just left. We have nothing. We have no resources. You know, I was working with Glenn Beck, to ask the Pakistanis to intervene on our behalf and help us get some of these flights out. I mean, that's what we've come to, where members of Congress are writing the Pakistanis and saying, look, this is, let's have some mutual agreement here that, you know, for humanitarian reasons, these flights got to leave. And they did. You know what? They stepped up and they did it because they have influence with the Taliban, and they saw this as a good thing. And, you know, we should praise them for that. And look, that doesn't mean we have a perfect relationship with Pakistan. It's not gonna happen. But you got to credit where credit's due. So that's just the unfortunate reality of where we've gotten to. This administration claims to care about people of color, but not these people of color, right? Like, maybe not Cubans, because they seem to want to vote Republican, right? So they don't really care about them. But this other voter bloc, they seem like they might vote Democrat. So let's let them in. I mean, it's a very cynical interpretation, but I think it's an accurate one.
Yeah, it definitely cynical, but definitely accurate, I think, as well, the way they play this. Now, I mean, obviously, we're going to have security ramifications. I've got a clip, Leon Panetta, saying he thinks we're going to see more domestic terror attacks in this country because of how we withdrew from Afghanistan. I don't think he's wrong. I'm just surprised he's saying it out loud.
He's 100% right. The intelligence is actually moving more quickly than we thought on this. I think the original interpretations or analysis that I saw, you know, a year or two, Al-Qaeda will be back to externalizing their operations, which is pretty soon, by the way. But now I'm hearing other leaks and reports from the intel community to say, look, it's on fire. Like, I mean, and why wouldn't it be? I mean, it's a terrorist Disneyland in Afghanistan. I mean, we've got... They're in a much better position than they were before, right? Like now they know there's like zero chance of America actually going back and taking the fight to them. Like they know there's zero chance of that right now. Mm-hmm. So they feel very emboldened. They've also got tons and tons of cash. I mean, I don't know if you've seen the videos of pallets and pallets of cash. That were designed for the Afghan government. It's like we forgot it, right? There's a little myth out there that we just like we're screwed up and, you know, it's the military's fault that we left our equipment there. No, it was always done on purpose. The withdrawal plan under Trump, Biden, it was always going to leave military equipment. I want everybody to know that. The problem is when you leave that equipment and that money and you give no chance to your allies to actually defend it, that's a huge dereliction of duty. That's the problem. And now terrorists have all of this under their control. They're selling it. It's spread to the winds. There's really not a good shot of us getting it back, to be honest. And, You know, it's tragic. We just had the 20th anniversary of 9/11, and for 20 years, we hadn't had no more 9/11, and people forget that, right? People actually think the opposite. And Biden said this. He said, you know, children of this generation have known nothing but war. And I was just scratching my head when he said that. I'm like, that it's the opposite. They've known nothing but peace. It was my generation that knew war. You know, cause first of all, it's my generation that fought it, not this generation. And it was my generation that remembers 9/11. And frankly, remembers the bombings before that, too. You know, 9/11 was just the culmination. And I'm so disappointed in America for not having that recollection and just having that sense of self. And I mean, we've lost so much perspective. And that's what led to these devastating decisions in Afghanistan and could potentially lead to more attacks like 9/11. And it's really problematic.
Congressman, before you get off here, I know you've got some votes, but one last question. We got a fiscal cliff coming up, the Democrats of their own creation, and now they expect you guys to help them be bailed out of their own mess. I'm assuming you're opposed to that.
Yes. Republicans are pretty united on this. Look, I mean, yesterday we voted on a continuing resolution. You know, it's worth noting for Republicans, I would vote for continuing resolutions every single day because that means no new policy, no new spending coming from Democrats. Now, the problem with this continuing resolution yesterday was that they also added in a basically unlimited, although temporary, increase to the debt limit. Mm-hmm. That's problematic because that's designed to just allow them to get their $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill through without having to add the debt limit spending into that. I guess it's a little wonky and complicated, but I want people to understand what a continuing resolution is. I mean, for Republicans, like that's what we should want all the time while Biden is president, because it just means no new spending. It doesn't mean we're moving the needle to the right the way we'd like to move it. But it means it's at least stationary, and but of course Democrats have poison pills in there. So you could see its government shut down because of this. I don't know. There's a lot of dynamics going on in the Democrat Party that are fascinating to watch.
Right.
And when we take control of the House, we better not make the same mistake.
Amen to that. Listen, thank you for stopping by. God bless you, and keep up the good work up there. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Eric. Good to be with you.
Congressman Dan Crenshaw of Texas up in Washington. They've got votes scheduled. He was going to come on in the next hour, and Pelosi moved up the votes in the House to 115. So he was in his office ready to head over to the Capitol. Thanks to him for stopping by. All right. When we come back, we got to talk about charter schools because there's new data out on them, and it has Democrats actually openly now saying maybe we need to kill off charter schools. I wish I was making that up. I'm not. I'll give you the details when we come back. Hello there. It is Eric Erickson here. The phone number, if you want to be on the show, 877-97-ERIC, 877-973-7425. Charter schools have boomed during the pandemic. This is from Axios, but listen to the wording here. Listen to the wording. Charter schools picked off hundreds of thousands of public school students across the U.S. This is from Axios. And it's a new analysis from the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools. But charter schools picked off hundreds of thousands of public school students across the U.S. during the pandemic. That's the opening. Except charter schools did not pick off hundreds of thousands of public school students. Hundreds of thousands of parents of public school students chose to send their kids to a charter school. And by the way, charter schools are public schools. This entire analysis comes, in fact, from the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools. Now, why it matters, according to Axios, the pandemic has weakened America's public education system as Zoom classes, teacher fatigue, and student disagreement take their toll. And that hobbled system is shedding students to charter schools, private schools, and homeschooling. Charter school enrollment is up 65% in Alabama, 78% in Texas. Bigger states have seen a significant jump, including Texas, 9%, New York, 7%, Ohio, 11%. School funding follows students. So public schools, that are not set up as charter schools will lose resources. Democrats are starting to say they're opposed to charter schools. You know, Stacey Abrams, who wants to maybe run for governor again in 2022 in Georgia, she's opposed to expanded charter schools in the state of Georgia. Texas Democrats are opposed to expanded charter schools in the state of Texas. And nationally, Joe Biden's Department of Education is signaling they would like to starve charter schools of funding because the public schools don't like the competition. Even though charter schools are public schools, they are set up with a level of flexibility and autonomy that even teachers unions have not been able to penetrate. The result is that charter schools are thriving where public schools are failing. And in fact, the charter schools, given their setup in most states, are allowed to get around mask mandates. The result is, of course, that the teachers unions and the Democratic political operatives out there want to kill them. From Stacey Abrams in Georgia to Joe Biden's own Department of Education, they want to deprive charter schools of funding. Now, here's a problem. The Democrats are so in bed, the teachers unions, and the teachers unions are so against charter schools that the Democrats have to be against the charter schools. And as more and more parents are moving their kids out of charter school or out of public schools into public charter schools, it's harder and harder for Democrats to justify wanting to kill off the charter schools. They'll probably want to slowly co-opt them. But, you know, homeschooling is growing as well. And in Illinois, a state that has been deeply hostile to homeschools in the past, the Democrats in the state legislature there want to expand regulation against homeschoolers. They actually want parents to be certified to teach their children at home in a homeschool situation, which in and of itself is an intrusion into the family alliance. But this goes back to what I was saying yesterday. Keep in mind that the Democrats actually view your children, as wards of the state. You are just there to serve the purpose for the state. It's not a good situation for Democrats' ability to keep parents. But as the Democratic Party elite tend to be single and childless, they tend to lose touch with families. And here's the thing people have to remember. Married people vote more than single people do. Increasingly, the intellectual elite within the Democratic Party are childless, and there's a growing number of them who are single. And as their world diverges from the public policy interests of parents with kids, it's going to make this reshaped alliance of suburban voters going to the Democrats difficult to maintain, because most voters in the suburbs have children and or grandchildren, and they want to keep their interests intact. And the Democrats diverging from that are going to cause all sorts of problems for their own coalition moving forward. Now, when we come back, let's talk about the Republican coalition. Donald Trump about to have a big rally in the state of Georgia.